Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to be talking about new research from the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute about different types of nuts helping ward off the return of colon cancer. And a study is linking the age of your physician when you're being treated to whether or not you have a higher chance of dying. Harvard Medical School. We're also going to look at the dangers of money. University of Hong Kong, the researchers have found that banknotes can transmit potentially pathogenic and antibiotic-resistant strains of bacteria. And also, tomatoes may fight stomach cancer. Then today, I'm not going to have a guest, so I can spend more time with TalkBack. And I have a couple of issues that I'm going to ask you to think about. One is a commentary from an article from Joel Renstrom from eon.com, and it's about, and their eyes glazed over. Quote, my college students are never entirely present in class, addicted to texts and tech. Is there any hope left for learning? Now, being a college teacher for many decades, I did not have this experience except in the recent term, but then I have specific rules. When you're in my class, that text doesn't, cell phone doesn't come out. You're there to learn. I'm there to help you. It's a good combination if we're in harmony. If not, well, then you're not going to learn, and that's the whole purpose of the exercise. So I know we have a lot of teachers listening, so hopefully you'll also call in after I read this article and you can share your points of view. Also today, we don't think about how our government wastes money, but it does. It's wasting our money, our taxes. Now, we should all pay taxes, and I believe that we should have a flat tax. And the reason is simple. Because the wealthiest people and the richest corporations have legions of accountants and tax lawyers, so they pay little or no taxes. But if we had one flat tax that was reasonable, like 20%, every corporation had to pay, no deductions, we would increase by at least $1 trillion a year in the income coming in, so we would then have some money to pay for these other essential needs that society requires. But we don't. So where's our money go? I'm going to share with you some of the ways, actual ways, from the Government Accountability Project to show you how they waste money, no one is ever held accountable, and they learn, no lesson is learned. They just continue to do it. Also today, I'm going to start a series of showing you just how many good quality articles exist that are never picked up in the mainstream and most of the alternative media on preying on the poor, how government and corporations use the poor as piggy banks. They exploit it. I'll be sharing at least six different articles. I'm not going to go through the whole article, but I'll go through enough so you get an idea. And also, being in prison for simply being poor, you've committed no crime, so we've returned to debtors' prisons. Why isn't that a major story? It should be. And then from our audio file today, I don't know how many of these I'll have a chance to get to, but we have some good ones. Julian Assange talks back about how corrupt the CIA is. Quote, the CIA is the world's most dangerously incompetent spy agency. That's according to Julian Assange. Also, doctors talk about why milk is not good and why can't we understand what Monsanto is doing is not in our best interest. James Corbett on Monsanto employing troll army, a whole group of people to silence anyone who criticized them. Well, we criticize them. Award-winning documentary, The Seeds of Death, in fact, played on one Colorado public television over 80 times, the most of any documentary in American history on a PBS station. And I want to tell you, speaking with the person at the station, they said, if I put myself on the line and I play this documentary, which I believe people need to see, I'm going to get a lot of flack. There's going to be all these trolls and people on our board who are aligned with the Koch brothers, Monsanto. Are you going to answer all their response? I said, yes. And that's exactly what we've done. They say, well, this can't be true. And we give all the documentation. Now they simply stopped because then we asked them questions. I'll answer your question. Now you tell me. I want to see your income tax. I want to know how much money you've made as a consultant, or did you get any money at any time in the last 10 years from any of these agricultural businesses? Suddenly they shut up. And we also have our own IT people who can track to see if they're trolls. And there's a legion of them. So anyhow, there's good reason that Monsanto doesn't want people like myself and Jeffrey Smith and others talking about genetic engineering. And you'll see more of that today. You'll hear it. Some good information for the consumer on that. So you see, we have a lot to share. Let's begin. First up, we should be eating nuts. Now, there are two ways to eat the nuts. One is salted, deep fried, and trans fats. That's how most nuts are prepared, and that's how people eat them. Not good. The best way would be to get organic, raw, and consume them either as nuts, whole, or as nut butters, where they simply have ground the nuts into a more digestible form of the nut. Not everyone can digest nuts easily. So a nut butter is very easy to digest. And I always suggest taking a teaspoon of walnut, sesame, sunflower, flaxseed, almond, and put it into your smoothie in the morning. From the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, quote, eating certain kinds of tree nuts, such as almonds, pecans, walnuts, hazelnuts, and cashews, has been linked it to a dramatically lower risk of colon cancer reoccurrence. And they followed a group of patients, and that's what they found. In fact, there was a 70% reduced chance if you did that. So that's terrific. So have the nuts, whether you have cancer or not, because they can help your heart also. And this I found unusual because you generally don't hear about this. Harvard Medical School took a look at patients treated by older hospital-based internists, known as hospitalists, who were more likely to have a patient die within a month of admission than those treated by younger physicians. According to the results of the Harvard Medical School and the Harvard T.C. Chan School of Public Health, the findings are being published this week in the British Medical Journal. And they reveal that if you have a physician under 40 versus over 60, you have a chance of dying. Wow, that's a big deal. That's 12.1%. Who knew? So now, well, why? And it didn't explain why. And it gave some suggestions. For example, it says, residency training sharpens the clinical skills of newly minted physicians because it exposes them to a great number of cases. But as physicians get further away from residency, their clinical skills may begin to decline somewhat. Our observation that physicians' age is of no consequence so long as they treat a high volume of patients supports that notion. So as long as you're getting older, but if you're treating a lot of patients, then your skills are still sharp. But if you're not, well, what about all the patients who are seen by doctors who don't see a lot of patients in private practice? Would that also hold true? For example, in an upcoming film, one of the hardest-hitting documentaries I've ever done is called Manufacturing Madness. You will see a scene, and in this scene, there is a very healthy person who goes to see a whole group of very well-known and highly respected board-certified psychiatrists. And anywhere from 2 minutes, 43 seconds, because it's timed, until I think the longest was 7 minutes, the doctor introduces themselves, says hello to the patient, does a diagnosis, and then writes a prescription. 2 minutes to 7 minutes. Turns out, when these people are then confronted on the street, here's a completely healthy person you just said had bipolar, or you said had some other psychiatric condition, and you gave them a drug for Paxil, Prozac, Zoloft, Effexor. Why? They were very nonchalant about it. They said, well, it's all subjective. Really? If it's all subjective, then why didn't you give them a placebo? And then handing the person right then and there peer-reviewed literature showing a placebo works just as well as the drug. Because the placebo won't do any harm. It's a sugar pill. The drug has serious side effects. And then you see all these side effects down the screen. And you think, what happened to the days, at least the days I remember, because some of my close friends, there were at least, I'm going to say, seven of my friends were psychiatrists and or psychologists, all working together in different clinical settings. And I knew Carmi Harari, Martin Shepard. In fact, there's a photograph of Martin Shepard that someone just put up when I was interviewing him on my early radio show back in 1969. And there he is. And then there's some of the others over the years. Now, these people would see you for an hour. And if they didn't have an answer for you, they wouldn't tell you you had something. There was a sense of humanistic value in that relationship. What kind of value is when you walk in and 2.5 minutes later you're given a diagnosis and a prescription? So we're losing reality in how we deal with patients. The patient and healing the patient, helping them understand the healing journey, no longer is what is dominant in medicine. So let's say you're no longer in a hospital. You're in private practice. Someone comes to see you. How much time do you spend? Are you listening? Or are you recommending tests that you make a profit from? Or that you fear that you might get malpractice, sued for malpractice if you don't give these extra tests? So, something to think about. All right? And that's what I would also put into that equation. Before you go to see a physician, always call and ask, how long would the physician spend with me personally? And I think that's very important, that you have quality time with a physician. Money. When my friends see that I handle money with just a tissue, something no one notices, and they think it's funny, and they open doors and going to a movie theater, they're always grabbing the door and open it. And I open the door, but I have a tissue. And they just laugh about it. You know, this is one of Gary's idiosyncratic, quirky behaviors. That's fine. But they should listen to this study out of the University of Hong Kong. If a commonly used item passed from person to person every day around the world was found to carry potentially harmful microbes, would you continue to use it? Well, a Dr. Lee from the University of Hong Kong and his colleagues have been investigating the bacterial community present on banknotes, your dollar bills. And this was published in Frontiers in Microbiology. And due to the global public health concern of antibiotic resistance, Dr. Lee and his team realized the importance of investigating how microbes are passed between humans and how antibiotic resistance can be spread around the world. And to do this, bacteria were scraped from the surface of these dollar bills, collected from hospitals and metro stations and all different kinds of shopping restaurants, and then they were taken to a lab and to determine the kind of bacterial present. And despite doubt as to whether microbes can even survive on dollar bills, the researchers found that these banknotes offer an environment that can indeed accommodate living bacteria. Over one-third of the bacteria identified on the banknotes consisted of potentially pathogenic species, widely recognized like E. coli and Vibrio, cholera, Who knew the cholera could end up on a dollar bill? And some of these strains can lead to death in infected people. Quote, in short, banknotes act as a medium absorbing bacteria from other environments, and the potential pathogens like live quite well on the banknote's surface. Well, so they're comparing the banknotes, bacteria on them, with people's hands and air and drinking water and all these other areas, and yeah, there are all ways of communicating. Now, I don't believe that we should be in some way excessive in our concern. Instead, we live in an environment. I live on a ranch. I've either lived on a ranch or a farm my entire adult life. Yeah, I have a place in the city, but my actual home is a ranch. So I'm working in the soil every day. I'm around animals, rescue animals, and you have to bond with them, all kinds of bacteria. But I don't let the dog lick me on the face. Cuddling, petting, hugging, yes. Because that dog and cat can transmit viruses and bacteria from their mouth that they're immune to into yours and you're not. That's especially dangerous for children. So when people come into my home, they take their shoes off. Why? Well, everything that I don't want in my home is on their shoe. It's going to go on my wood floors. It's going to dry. And then any air current at all, just walking, is enough to cause that to float into the air and come down all the surface areas. So what's outside, leave it outside. And then you simply take hydrogen peroxide or rubbing alcohol once or twice a day on some paper towels and just wipe down the areas that are being touched a lot, like refrigerator handles, doorknobs, telephones, the entire telephone, computer keyboards, armrests, and even where you sit. Why? Because recently, at a new movie theater in Los Angeles, they tested bacteria on seats and found that in a new theater, there was approximately 3,000 feces per seat. Now, you can't see this with the naked eye, but that means a lot of people sitting in those seats were sweating. Microbes and sweat cause movement. The movement goes through their underwear, through their pants, and onto the seat. Now, do you think it's any different in a cab? Do you think it's any different in a ballpark? So fine. You can buy a little cushion. In fact, when I go downtown to the office each day, when I'm in the city, I have this little cushion. Fits in my shoulder bag. Open the door. Again, I got a paper towel. No one sees it. But it's my paper towel touching the doorknob, not my hand. Get inside, just put it on the seat, and I sit on it. No one even notices it. And this way I get out, I take it out, fold it up, put it back in. I know which side I'm sitting on. I know which side is dirty by being on the seat. But at least I've done something to minimize my exposure to toxins. Now, if you think that it's not really that important, then ask yourself this. How many Americans suffered food poisoning and water poisoning last year? How many Americans died from MRSA? How many Americans died of infections they got from inside a hospital? They didn't have the infection when they went in. How many died post-surgery because a physician didn't fully sanitize their hands, or there was some form of non-autoclaved or improperly autoclaved equipment used in surgery? Yeah, we're talking about poisoning, hundreds of million of cases. Deaths, tens of thousands of deaths. So it's not an issue that doesn't have consequences. So you can be hygienic in a real world without it disrupting the quality of your relationship in that world. You're just being a little smarter. That's all. And finally, from Oncology Research Center in Italy, tomatoes may fight stomach cancer. Now, we know that tomato extracts can inhibit the growth and malignant cloning of stomach cancer cells. This is important. Researchers analyzed whole tomato extracts for their ability to tackle gastric cancer cell lines. Quote, their anti-tumoral effects seemed to be important in this case. Now, was it the lycopene? Could have been. The kind of acid balance? Could have been. But whatever it is in that tomato, it works. So one more way to help you, if you've got Helicobacter pylori, which is an infection, it's a bacterial infection in the stomach, but it can lead to cancer of the stomach. Tomato juice, cabbage juice, combining tomato and cabbage juice for ulcers and stomach and intestinal problems, lesions and ulcers and cancer is terrific. I remember years ago, I was working on a report and I got a call from a man named Guy Richards. And Guy Richards was one of these old-fashioned, outstanding journalists for the New York Herald Tribune. And in one of our meetings, he was clearly in pain. And I said, what's wrong? He said, well, my stomach's acting up. I got to take my meds. And I said, what's wrong with your stomach? He said, well, I've got ulcers. How long you had them? Oh, I've had them a long time. When you're in the business I'm in, and you're under stress, and you're drinking a lot of coffee, you're going to have ulcers. That's what he said. So I said, let's try something. We were meeting in my apartment. I went in and I made him a cabbage juice. And I said, try this. Well, he wasn't into taking vitamins, but he tried it. And after 3 days, no more pain. And after 2 weeks, no more ulcers. It had all healed. Well, that made a believer out of him. So for those of you who have ulcers, intestinal issues, cabbage juice, sauerkraut juice, and organic tomato juice, those are terrific for you. I'm Gary Noll. Back in a moment. We have a lot of good stuff to come, all of it meant to empower us. Please stay with us. I'm asking people not to call in just yet. We'll be opening our phones in about 10 minutes. I have a lot to go over, so there'll be a lot of different things to talk about. Also, I want to mention that a lot of you listen over your land-based radio, which is good. But some can't always be at a radio. Others listen over the computer. And starting in 2 weeks, you'll be seeing a whole new, brand new state-of-the-art studio. And all of our guests and video clips you'll be able to see on monitors. It's really going to be cool. But a lot of you just have a portable listening device. You're out, you're about, you're traveling. It's noon to one, Monday to Friday. You can listen by telephone. Let me give you that number. Please always have this because you never know when you're going to tune in and there might be a problem and you won't be able to hear the show. By telephone, you'll always be able to hear it. Let me give you the number. Write it down, please. 701-801-3662. 701-801-3662. But we also found that we have had an enormous surge. Why? I'm not sure, but a young college-educated men are listening to the program. They have gone up to a huge number as a percentage in the last 6 months. And they're listening in the archives at night. That's what our analytics show. So if you want to listen anywhere in America or Canada at night, and you're out and about, or you're not near a computer, and you just want to pick up a phone, listen, or any portable device, you can call in and download any one of five current archive programs. Here's that number, 701-719-9976. 701-719-9976. Now, I'm going to share a story here because I think it's important and people are not dealing with it. It's kind of the thing, well, it's just too big an issue to deal with. It's too complicated. This is Joel Renstrom from Eon. Here's what Joel says. I have a rule about cell phones in class. If one disrupts us by ringing, vibrating, or sounding an alarm, the owner has to sing a song or bust some dance moves in front of the class. While my students, undergraduate at Boston University, who are taking classes on writing and research, agree that there is a problem if they can't go 15 minutes without checking their phones, few of them can resist, despite knowing that this is my biggest pet peeve. A University of Nebraska Lincoln study indicates that 80% of college students send text messages during class. Nearly 100% of them text before and after class. In the minutes before class, the ones I used to spend shooting the breeze with students about TV shows, sports, or others, what they did over the weekend, we now sit in technologically induced silence. Students rarely ever talk to each other anymore. Gone are the days when they gabbed about the impossible chemistry midterm they just took or the quality of the food at the dining halls. Around the 30-minute mark in class, their hands inch towards their backpacks or into their pockets, fingers feeling around for the button as though their mere shape offers comfort. When I end class, they whip out those phones with a collective sigh of relief as though they've all just been allowed to go to the bathroom after having holding it in all day. Even when my students stash their cell phones, my classes look like an Apple commercial. Faces hide behind screens embossed with the same famous fruit. I have no delusions that they're taking notes for class or referencing that day's reading. A University of Waterloo professor who put a postgraduate at the back of his lecture hall to observe his students learned that 85% of them did something unrelated to class on their laptops. A Cornell University study confirms that most students engage in high-tech doodling and communications with others during class. One might think that the whopping $65,000 cost of attending Boston University per year would provide ample reason to maintain focus during class, but one would be wrong. Even students who take notes on their laptops miss out. A study from Princeton University shows that we process information better when taking notes by hand because writing is slower than typing, and which helps students learn and retain the material. Similarly, people better comprehend what they're reading if it's on paper rather than on a screen. In a study from the University of Stavanger in Norway, readers on Kindle struggle to remember plot details in comparison with those who read printed books, perhaps because the physical act of turning the pages helps our memories encode the words. Another study revealed comprehension loss for subjects reading PDF versions of text. Such findings have caused professors to ban computers in classroom, which is something I used to do but can't anymore. An increasing number of students present me with documentation from the Student Disability Office that entitles them to use a laptop to take notes. If students see a few classmates with laptops, they inevitably start using their own as well. I can tell them that only a couple people are sanctioned to use the computers because of learning or cognitive disabilities without infringing on the student's privacy. So I try instead to encourage students to take notes by hand and ask them, asked to see their faces, not their Apple computers. In an effort to save my students' exorbitant course pack fees, I used to photocopy course readings. But when my department clamped down on copier use, I scanned the articles and put them online, which meant I had to allow students to open their laptops during discussions. On the other hand, they're adults. If they want to go to shop for shoes on the Zappos website or look at celebrities' Instagram accounts during class, they'll have to deal with the consequences. But our discussions suffer, which makes my job harder. When reading on screen, students don't annotate or reread. They get glassy-eyed, zone out, and then struggle to find quotes they only vaguely remember when it comes time to write the paper. The endless opportunities for distraction also means they miss out other aspects of class. Important, and that's when they come to me and we have some version of the following conversation. Student, I have no idea what's going on. Me, what do you mean, no idea? Well, the assignment sheet details all the requirements. We reviewed them in class, and we've read example essays. What exactly are you having trouble understanding? Student, I don't know. Everything. Well, I used to jump to the conclusion the students with whom I had such interactions were inherently flawed academic lost causes. But that's a reductive explanation and doesn't get at the heart of the problem. It's not just they have trouble paying attention or are distracted by their phones and laptops in classroom. The problem is their use of technology in general. Technology demands a significant amount of time and attention and has conditioned them to not question. It takes up more and more of their bandwidth, and the net effect is lobotomization. Consumed by technology they cannot bear to disable or ignore, my students lose awareness of what's going on around them. They don't know what they're missed. Often they don't know that they missed anything. They're still accountable for it, but such mindlessness has become an epidemic. A study from The Ohio State University found walking while texting has caused a significant rise in injuries. In China, sidewalks contain a special lane for people who can't be bothered to look up from their cell phones. And in the German city of Augsburg, there's a traffic signal on the ground for people who would otherwise endanger themselves by failing to notice red lights. Part of the reason people can't seem to look up from their phones is that we've convinced ourselves we're multitasking rather than failing to focus. Like the way I toggle between various browser tabs and apps even when I write this. A California State University study monitored middle, high school, and college students who have been instructed to research something important for 15 minutes. 2 minutes in, students' focus started to wane as they checked messages, texts, and various websites. The average student lasted 6 minutes before caving in to temptation to engage in social media. And despite being watched, students spent only approximately 65% of the allotted time studying. Given that most students spend far longer than 15 minutes trying to do coursework, it's easy to see how little gets done, how checking messages or opening up another browser tab would be increasingly difficult to resist, especially if we tell ourselves it's related to work or study. At the end of each semester, my students submit a portfolio that chronicles their work over the past 16 weeks. I ask them to reflect on what they've learned, both in terms of tangible skills and about their own tendencies. Students write insightful and honest self-analysis. They confess all kinds of bad habits they've developed in college or perpetuated since high school, such as procrastinating, skipping proofreading, or staying up all night playing video games. Increasingly, students express dismay at their ability to manage time and to stay focused. Though I'm grateful on a daily basis that Facebook and cell phones weren't around when I was in college, this isn't a new problem. Students have always found more satisfying ways to spend time than writing essays and studying for tests. Even with nothing urgently or not so urgently fun to do, they have always waited until the last minute. But now students who aren't necessarily procrastinators, who used to be able to focus on assignments, find it harder and harder to fight distraction. This semester, a student who initially impressed me as a rising star in my class wrote the following in his final portfolio. I constantly procrastinate, leaving huge chunks of writing until the last minute, or sometimes until a few minutes past the last minute. Even now, on the last easiest assignment, I left it until the last minute, and I'm still procrastinating. It's 3 a.m, and instead of consistently working on my portfolio, I'm watching a video review of hammock. And I've never even used a hammock. I have a serious problem in making myself do work, and even I'm not entirely sure why. Even when the work interests me, as this class does, and the work is important, I'm still bizarrely capable of feeling absolutely no compulsion to work. It is almost like the student is describing the body snatcher scenario, getting taken over by forces he's aware of but can't seem to control. But what are these forces exactly? Sure, students can use one of many available products to curtail their online forays and curb their appetite for distraction, but these products block websites or internet use. They don't block text messages or Skype calls, and they can induce focus. And while it might sound easy enough to simply turn off a phone or leave it at home when heading to the library or to class, most people aren't comfortable with that. After all, 75% of Americans take their phones into the bathroom. People between the ages of 18 and 24 check their phones an average of 74 times a day. But why? As people become accustomed to getting immediate answers, they do less digging for information themselves. The simple answer is we're obsessed. What the term requires unpacking, even though it might make us anxious, the official term is techno-stressed. We feel we must constantly check our various accounts because we can. Many people are also driven by the fear of missing out because of how much happens in any given instant. We're missing something when we're unplugged, and we're often compelled to log back on to see what's happening since our last visit or to confirm that nothing has happened. Cultural and professional expectations play into this behavior as well. Employers expect responses to email at night and on weekends, as do students, and most of us feel pressured to oblige. This expectation causes a feedback loop, and as people become accustomed to getting immediate answers, they do less digging for information themselves. I can't count how often my students email me to ask me about my office hours. I write back the same every time. Check the first page of the syllabus. They email me back without checking to see if the syllabus has the answer because they can, because I'm supposed to be accessible and answer their questions all the time. This is one of the main reasons I won't get a smartphone. I would check my work email in the bathroom and feel compelled to answer such emails, thereby training students that such behavior isn't just acceptable but fruitful. And it goes on from there. Now, here's the issue. It is not just impacting students. It's impacting everyone. Recently, I had an opportunity to write a book on a very important topic. And I said I would, but I would not curtail it. And so there was about a year delay in getting the contract. Why? They said repeatedly, people's attention span is so short, you can't write a book more than like 200 pages is now considered a long book. And I said, well, then I won't be writing that book. Get someone else to. But you have the knowledge. They don't. Well, we don't care about knowledge today because knowledge is detached from wisdom today. Knowledge is more about the pragmatic approach to our beliefs or others' beliefs that we're encouraged to believe in without questioning. We don't question knowledge today. We don't question so-called facts today. We don't question people's values, beliefs, or what they're using as truth today. And I gave examples. In time, I was allowed to write the book I wanted to write. And to everyone's surprise, it sold in hardback at $75. It was a 1,600-page book. It sold 75,000 copies. In fact, just today, I'm out on the road, that one of my books sold 875,000 copies of a hardback book. And this is a big book. I think it was around 1,000 pages. So today, publishers, the moment they see how long a manuscript is, they'll just reject it out of hand, no matter how important the information in that manuscript is. They want short things, and I refuse to write short things. If I'm going to write something short, I'll just write it on the internet as a short article. Even there, you won't be picked up and your article won't be shared if it's more than like 6 pages. But what if the information necessary to present your arguments take 12 pages? Well, then your site will probably be the only one that carries it. One of the books that I published this year is 1,100 pages. It's doing extremely well. It's a book on women's health. Now, I could have cut out half the illnesses. I could have cut back half the protocols. But then you would have had a book, let's say, half that size. You would have had 600 pages. That still would have been too big. if I would have done a book the way they wanted me to do a book, I would have done maybe 12 conditions, not 72. That's the world we're living in today, where the marketplace and people's attention spans dictate what they will accept or reject. Now, fortunately, there are people in our society, mainly older people, who want quality, who don't mind that something is longer if it is inspiring and useful and important, just like a movie. I recently, when I was waiting on a plane, they had The Godfather on, and I was watching it. That was a long movie. And in my opinion, The Godfather 2, one of the best movies ever made. Could you imagine if today a producer says, no, we got to do this film in an hour and 20 minutes, half of what it was. Well, then what do you leave out? So I just believe that we have to understand today that we pay a price when one generation decides that we're too busy being distracted to look at anything of quality for any length of time, but don't ask us to remember it, don't ask us to understand it, don't ask us to engage in intellectual construct because we can't. And one of the most important ways I saw this was I heard about this guy named Milo. And someone says, why don't you bring him on the show and debate him, Gary? I said, well, let's see. He's like a firebrand and very popular all over college campuses, packing rooms. And so one Saturday afternoon, I went through a lot of his lectures and I found him to be one of the dumbest human beings I've ever experienced in my life. But it was very revealing. He's gay, and he once, in one of his statements, he said, because I'm gay, I can say anything, no matter how offensive, and no one can say anything back because then you'll be attacked for being homophobic. Well, I know a lot of gay people. They don't have to use vulgarity, debasing statements in order to make their points. They can be sensitive, point on, literate, and make a point that can move us, inspire us, educate us. Milo had his own undoing, and his reputation was destroyed. He destroyed his own reputation. But he could have had that reputation destroyed long ago if anyone ever went to his tapes and saw what he's actually said. But evidently, people didn't do their homework. But to have a whole classroom stand up and cheer you for just screaming vulgarities and demeaning people, demeaning feminists, demeaning people with handicaps. No. No, we have come a long way down that rabbit hole of stupid. And I believe it's time that we, who care about critical thinking, we who are engaged every day in social issues, we not allow ourselves to be tempted to in any way alter the quality of our material for a dumbed-down group of stupid people. That's my personal view. Now you can share yours. Talk back, 888-874-4888. And I'm also going to be opening up our calls tomorrow on any aspect of that you would like talk back, health, nutrition. That'll be tomorrow. But today I want you to get with this. And also, I'm going to play a clip now before we go to our... This is about James Corbett talking about Monsanto employing a troll army to silence online dissent. Please listen.
Corbett here, CorbettReport.com, May 15th, 2017, with a thought for the day on a news story that probably disappeared from your news radar very quickly, but probably shouldn't have. It's up here at globalresearch.ca. Monsanto accused of hiring army of trolls to silence online dissent, according to court papers. Biotech giant Monsanto is being accused of hiring, through third parties, an army of internet trolls to counter negative comments while citing positive ghost-ridden pseudoscientific reports which downplay the potential risks of their products. This is related to an ongoing court case in the U.S. District Court in San Francisco, which is 50 lawsuits, so over 50, I believe, that have been rolled up into one trial that is basically a bunch of people claiming that their non-Hodgkin lymphoma and other diseases caused them or their relatives sickness and even death, while Monsanto concealed the potential risks. The documents related to this court case are being compiled by U.S. Right to Know, which is a food safety whistleblower organization, and made available online. Some of these documents are quite interesting, including some documents released late in April that show the plaintiffs alleging that Monsanto targeted all online materials and even social media comments that indicate potential dangers of its products. According to one document released late in April, Monsanto even started the aptly named Let Nothing Go program to leave nothing, not even Facebook comments, unanswered through a series of third parties that employs individuals who appear to have no connection to the industry, who in turn post positive comments on news articles and Facebook posts defending Monsanto, its chemicals, and GMOs, the documents read. On a larger scale, Monsanto allegedly quietly funnels money to think tanks such as the Genetic Literacy Project and the American Council on Science and Health, organizations intended to shame scientists and highlight information helpful to Monsanto and other chemical producers, according to the plaintiffs. I'll let you continue reading through this article and the information therein, but a very interesting story, and I'll link you, of course, as always.
So that's just to show you that we have the truth on our side, that these pesticides are toxic, we shouldn't be using them, and on the other side is a multi-billion-dollar corporation that is hiring people now to attack anyone who tells the truth. That's why you have to know which sites you can trust, and because these trolls are everywhere. Also, I want you to hear this piece on doctor's advice on dairy milk. It's a short 1 minute, 33 seconds.
When you think about it, the purpose of cow's milk, I did most of my growing up on a dairy farm in Wisconsin. The purpose of cow's milk is to turn a 65-pound calf into a 400-pound cow as rapidly as possible. Cow's milk is baby calf growth fluid. That's what this stuff is. Everything in that white liquid, the hormones, the lipids, the proteins, the sodium, the growth factors, the IGF, all, every one of those is meant to blow that calf up to a great big cow. It wouldn't be there. And whether you pour it on your cereal as a liquid, whether you clot it into yogurt, whether you eat it into cheese, whether you freeze it into ice cream, it's baby calf growth fluid. And women eat it, and it stimulates their tissues, and it gives women breast lumps. It makes the uterus get big, and they get fibroids, and they bleed, and they get hysterectomies, and they need mammograms, and gives guys man boobs. This is cow's milk, is the lactation secretions of a large bovine mammal who just had a baby. It's for baby calves. You know, I tell my patients, go look in the mirror. Do you have big ears? Do you have a tail? Are you a baby calf? If you're not, don't be eating baby calf growth fluid in any level. There's nothing in it people need.
Now, this is from Barbara Ehrenreich. And then I'm going to take calls at 888-874-4888. She says, preying on the poor. Lenders, including major credit companies, as well as payday lenders, have taken over the traditional role of the street corner loan shark, charging the poor insanely high rates of interest. When supplemented with late fees, themselves subject to interest, the resulting effective interest rate can be as high as 600% a year, which is perfectly legal in many states. It's not just that private sectors preying on the poor. Local governments are discovering that they can partially make up for declining tax revenues through the fines and fees and other costs imposed on indigenous defendants, often for crimes no more dastardly than driving with a suspended license. And if that seems like an inefficient way to make money, given the high cost of locking people up, a growing number of jurisdictions have taken to charging defendants for their court costs and even the price of occupying a jail cell. the poster case for government persecution of the down and out would have to be Edwina Anolin, a homeless Michigan woman who was jailed for failing to pay $104 a month to cover the room and board charges for her 16-year-old son's incarceration. When she received a back paycheck, she thought it would allow her to pay for her son's jail stay. Instead, it was confiscated and applied to the costs of her own incarceration. So here's the question. What crime did Edwina commit? Oh, she didn't. But she was arrested and put in jail? Yeah, because she was supposed to pay her son's incarceration fees. So a parent is sent to jail for something their child did, and she's poor? Yes. So that is just one way. And I'm going into depth on this next week and on tomorrow's program as well. But right now, let's say hello to Alan. Alan, your turn.
Hi, Gary. I just want to say that you talk about Israel a lot. And I just like to let you know that if the Arabs put down their weapons, there would be peace. But if Israel put down its weapons, they would be slaughtered.
Well, that's your point of view, okay? I would hold a different point of view. I believe that the average Arab does not have weapons. Are there radicalized members of the Arab community? Yes. Are there radicalized members of the Jewish community? Yes. But look at who controls the apartheid, the living conditions, the work conditions, the flow of money, the flow of medicines, the flow of supplies. Who has had the greatest incursion and suffered the most deaths? If you truly, Alan, care about humanity, then look at both individuals, both groups as being sacred and deserving to live in peace and harmony with one another. But Zionist views, you can share them all you want. Let's also say hello to Maria. Hi, Maria from Baltimore. You're on the air. So Maria's not there?
This is Julie.
Hi, Julie from New York. Your turn.
Yes. In addition to what you said about the cell phones, I've noticed a disturbing occurrence that I see people here in New York with baby carriages that instead of pacifiers, they give the little children, the toddlers, a cell phone, and usually they're just watching cartoons, but I think it starts the habit. It replaces the pacifier with another pacifier, which I think is not a good thing at all. And I'm probably one of your senior listeners, but my personal experience, given that I went to college in my late 20s and I had been trained as a secretary, I took history on Saturday morning, a three-hour history class, and because I had been a secretary and could take dictation, I could listen to the professor for 3 hours and take very good notes. And then when I would type them up, it reinforced what I had heard, and I got A's. I had never been an A student, but because of that routine that was just happenstance, it really solidified what I was hearing in class. And yet now I think the students don't have the ability to focus, and they're not learning how to focus and take notes. So.
Did it ever occur to people that the student doesn't come into class unaffected? What did they learn at home? Did they have to take notes at home? Were they disciplined at home? Was there any consequence to acting out or not engaging? Did the people sit at a table with no phones allowed? I won't go out with a person if they have a cell phone. Period.
Yeah, I feel the same way. Yeah,
if we're going to go have dinner together, or if we're going to go for a walk, you pick up that telephone, you're disrespecting the time and that moment. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day.